From the Texas Veterinary Medical Association in Austin, Texas, this is Veterinary Vitals, a podcast that focuses on current news in the Texas veterinary profession. I'm your host, Audrea Wood. Today on Veterinary Vitals, I speak with Dr. Deborah Zorin, professor of the Small Animal Clinical Sciences Department at Texas A&M University School of Veterinary Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. Dr. Zorin specializes in emergency preparedness and response and the use of simulations in the teaching of disaster. She earned her Bachelor's of Science in Animal Science from Kansas State University, a Master's of Science in Clinical Sciences from Iowa State University, and her Doctor of Veterinary Medicine and PhD in Nutrition, both from Texas A&M University. I caught up with Dr. Zorin at Southwest Veterinary Symposium in San Antonio, where she was meeting people and giving them tours of the Texas A&M Veterinary Emergency Team medical trailer.
My long history is I'm a 1984 graduate of Kansas State University, and I'm went to private practice and loved it, but loved medicine, and so decided that I was going to go back and get an internal medicine residency. Did that at Iowa State, which was way too cold and reminded me how much I did not want to live in the North.
Right.
And I met my husband, and my husband's an academic, and so we moved to Texas A&M University, which was the best thing that could have ever happened. And so I started out because I had just gotten out of my residency doing my PhD in nutrition. And so I am all out, all Aggie all the time, and he was a full professor and whatever. He's the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences now.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Yes. No, we've kind of taken over Texas A&M University.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. So I started out teaching at the vet school in internal medicine. John August, our current dean, hired me. He was the department head.
Really?
Time.
Wow.
Yes, it's real. The 6 degrees of separation thing is real.
Yeah.
I've been there since very early on. I started officially working in 1996 because that's when I finished my PhD. Teaching internal medicine, I had a passion for feline nutrition because of my nutrition PhD. I spent years and years and years and years and years traveling around talking about cat nutrition and internal medicine and all of that. I developed a strong connection with the working canines of Task Force 1 because in the late 90s they came over to A&M and they were looking for a couple of people to be their canine veterinary connection. And I raised my hand because at the time I was just new and young. That sounds very interesting. Let's do that. And it was two things. It was very interesting because working dogs, so there's a lot of very interesting things about that, nutritionally and otherwise. But the other thing was it introduced me to disaster response, because that's what they do, right? Texas Task Force 1 is urban search and rescue. They go to tornadoes and floods and fires and this and that. And even though I wasn't deploying way back then, I had friends that were. I just got a text from one of them. And so it connected me both to disaster world while I was doing my day job, right? And so I knew the dogs that went to 9/11. I knew the dogs that deployed. So this was the beginning of sort of what my next career was going to be, I think. For all of the starting in 2000 to 2010, I'm just being an internist doing Texas A&M things, right? You know, doing things. Katrina changed things for us at A&M because when all of that happened over in New Orleans and to LSU and Baton Rouge, all of that crazy, it was a real eye-opener for us. And we looked over there and said, you know, but for the grace of God, that could have been us. If it would have hit Houston, we would have been in the same mess. We didn't have a plan. Nobody knew what to do. And so that's when we actually started talking about having a college-wide plan, and that's when I met Moyer and Bissett. And that became the college disaster team. It wasn't a team yet, but it was the beginnings. And that was after Katrina. And then, you know, life goes on. And then Ike happened. And then the state of Texas said, you know, we should build something. And so Texas Animal Health Commission, Dee Ellis, was at Animal Health Commission at the time, came over to Bill Moyer at A&M, who was the head of department, and said, will you guys do something if I get you a pile of money? And he said, yes, and here we are. And so in 2009 is when the first beginnings, I mean, tiny, tiny beginnings happened. It didn't really start to explode until after the Bastrop wildfires. That was kind of our first big, oh boy. And it was when we realized that we needed to, like, we needed to do some different things. We needed to learn how to do this. We needed, you know, it started really growing us. And that also reminded us that we don't deploy all the time, but there's a whole lot of people that don't know anything about it. So we should start teaching. And so that chart behind you over there is...
So this map of Texas we're looking at, it is different counties are... Counties or cities?
They're counties.
Counties. Counties are...
There's some cities on there. They're little starred things, but most of it's counties.
And they are colored based on where in the rotation they are. So the Burgundy counties...
Burgundies were deployments mostly.
Yes, deployments. And then blue, we have deployments and emergency planning.
Yeah, so places we've done both.
Places you've done both. Uh-huh. And then green is just the emergency planning so far.
So we haven't actually deployed to that location for any disaster, but we've gone there on one of our rotation trips. And every 2 weeks we have a rotation. And so we have a rotation trip every 2 weeks. But a lot of these counties, even though they have a green on them, we might have visited them like 3 or 4 times, because sometimes it's a multi-stage process, right? Yeah. So, so it's from about 2014 until now, we've done over 75 counties, which is not all of Texas by any standards, because there's 254. But
Texas.
We have... pretty big target.
Making a big headway.
And it's obviously been very focused on counties that tend to have disasters more often. So you see the tornado counties, and you see the fire counties, and you see the hurricane counties are very heavily represented. Because once we started doing it, they're like, you know, it's kind of like your neighbor gets a new car, and then you go, oh, it's time for us to get a new car. And so we would go visit a county in an area, and then they would go, hey, they got a thing. Let's have a thing. And so, yeah, that's how it's happened. But the beautiful thing about it, the beautiful, beautiful thing about it is not only did they have that plan that's in writing, because a lot of counties have a plan up here. The emergency manager says, this is what we're going to do. Or they say, I've written down, I'm going to call this guy to do this and this guy to do this and this. But what they're going to do with that isn't been thought through. So I like to tell the students, plan isn't a plan until it's written down, and it's not a really good plan until you actually practice it. In other words, you try it. You take what you wrote and you try to see if it works. Exercise it. And so that's another thing that we do with counties. So a county says, you know what, we're going to practice this. I love taking the students there, because not only, one, do they get to see how it works or doesn't work or what do we need to adjust, but it also now creates all of the connections of people knowing people, so when something bad happens, you've met before. This is not people that are unknown to you, right? And in the middle of a mess, in the middle of the worst day for somebody's life, you know, the tornado that just blew everything down, or the fire that just burned everything, Maui, good Lord, when bad things happen, it's really good to know the people that you're working with to try to get through that. And so when we go plan with counties and go meet with emergency managers and animal control people and shelter people and local veterinarians and whoever is part of the planning process in that community, now we've created a connection between them and us. And so those are incredible, valuable things, and that's what we do when we're not deployed, which is most of the time, because thank God deployments are here and there and yonder, right?
Yes. And so how many deployments do you think you do on average each year?
So it's crazy. If you say average, it's probably 2 a year, maybe 3 a year, a spring, a summer, a fall. Because we don't go to everything that goes wrong, because if it's a local event and the local people can do it, that's what's supposed to happen, right? So we go to the ones where either the locals are overwhelmed, it's a really small community, they just don't have the resources, there's no veterinarians, or there's only one, or whatever, like Perryton, the tornado. That was a bad tornado, but they only had one or two vet practices, right? So a community that might have 10 vet practices might have been fine. A community with only two, and they're already part of the tornado, now they need help. And so that's what it depends on, right? It depends on the size of it, the impact of it. There's been a ton of fires this past month, fires everywhere, but not a lot of animal impacts. And because of that, we haven't been involved. A year and a half ago, in the Eastland fire, huge animal impacts, because huge herds burned, an entire community burned. Those are the kind of events where we will get called in, because it's the local animal response community, the veterinarians, the animal controls, were overwhelmed with all of the impacts. So those are the kind that we get called in.
Okay, and so you said you guys usually come into these bigger disasters, mm-hmm. or outbreaks, mm-hmm. where the community can't handle it. Mm-hmm. Who makes that call to mm-hmm. you and
That's
says, this is one that we need you for, come mm-hmm. on in?
Great question. So because we're a state asset, and because all deployments are managed things, right? You just can't go do. You have to be asked to go do. And so in order for us to have our legal and medical and all of the protections that come, you have to be a requested entity. The second thing is, in order for us to get reimbursed for doing this, and so in other words, we use a bunch of drugs, we use a bunch of bandages, or we use whatever we use, that gets reimbursed to us by being a part of the response system, right? This is a very organized thing. It's got its own language and terminology. It's called the Incident Command System. Fire departments work with it. Police departments work with it. Emergency hospital systems work with it. So does the disaster response system. It's all part of a very structured system that's integrated so that everybody can talk to each other in the same language. The animal people do the same thing, and we're part of that. So when we get requested by the person in charge of this, which is typically the Emergency Management Coordinator, or EMC, of a county. So for example, let's pick Wimberley. That's a place we've been. Wimberley, when the flood happened, years and years ago, but the flood happened. Wimberley's in Hays County. The Hays County Emergency Management Coordinator would have had to put in an official request for us called a STAR. Official requests can go out for anything. I need a generator. This is a request for that. I need the vet team. This is a request for that. It's called a STAR, State of Texas Assistance Request. It goes up to the state. They approve it. They send us notification. You've been requested. It's been approved. Go. So that's complicated, but that's why the local communities all have to understand the system. People that live within that system do. Veterinarians who do not live within that system don't always, which is part of the reason we have a rotation to help them know that. Part of the reason why we go to counties to help them know what they can request. And the whole point of it is just so they know, if your veterinary community is overwhelmed, there is help. This is who we are. This is what we can bring.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, that's really interesting, because mm-hmm. I'm interested in the back end stuff, the mm-hmm. paperwork, the mm-hmm. administrative. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how did this happen? Mm-hmm. Who's in charge of what? Mm-hmm. How do we get reimbursed?
Mm-hmm.
That's always what I want to know. Mm-hmm. But it's fascinating.
It is. You have to be asked to be there first. And then it's a process. Once we're on the ground, we have to be very meticulous about hours of our people, hours of our generators, how much fuel we're using, what are the drugs we're using, all of it. And then at the end of it, this all goes into a reimbursement package that goes up. Typically in Texas, our events are a state-declared disaster, so we're submitting to the state of Texas for reimbursement. But if it's a federally declared disaster like Harvey, then it's going to go up to the federals for reimbursement.
Well, tell me about this amazing mobile veterinary clinic we're in right now at SWIVS. Mm-hmm. I have seen this. I saw this at SWIVS last year and always gets lots of attention. It's a beautiful, long, white trailer. How long is it?
It's 35 feet.
It's 35 feet. Mm-hmm. And what features and tools, equipment do you carry on it?
So this is one of our three mobile medical trailers, primarily dedicated to dealing with companion animals. We've had other things besides companion animals in here, but not horses and cows. But you can, sheep and goats can get in here and wildlife can get in here. I mean, you know, things small enough. But its entire purpose is to be a mobile medical platform. And anybody that works in the medical field knows that drugs and medical supplies and things like to be climated. They like not to be hot or cold or humid or all of these things. And in order to keep our all of these things and our medical equipment, so we have an ultrasound, we have some basic lab point of care things, all of that needs to be kept in a medically appropriate climate controlled space. So these trailers are all that. If you look up, we're open the doors now because we're inside and it's cool and nice, but if we're outside and it's 105, the air conditioners are working the brains off and the doors are closed, right? And so these spaces tend to be the spaces where we do what we like to call our higher level care. So in other words, if you go to a disaster and you park next to the fairgrounds, which is the typical location for animals to be brought either for sheltering or triage or to find their owners or to whatever. Every community tries to develop that location. Where are you going to take the animals that you find? Where are you going to take the horses that need to be pulled out of the water so that mom can find them? Or the dogs running on the road, where do you take them? It's typically a fairgrounds in most communities just because that's a large space, many buildings, easy access, known space. And so when we get called in, it's typically fairgrounds that we're going to get called in to set up next to. And when we do, a lot of the animals that are being housed are in there. The animals that are coming to us in a variety of ways. They might be coming in animal control trucks or trailers or whatever, and all of them need to be triaged first. A lot of times triage happens outside of this trailer. But if you were to say, let's say you were triaging in a tent or you were triaging in that fair barn next to you, and you identified a dog that was in really tough shape, needed extra care, those come over here. Because that way you can get them out of the mayhem, you can get them into where all of your gear is, where all of your drugs are, where all of your things are, and actually get to work. This is a space we like to use when the search and rescue dogs, we spend a lot of time deploying with search and rescue teams, Texas Task Force 1. When we went to Florida, that was our primary mission, to help the search and rescue dogs that were searching in Hurricane Ian. Coming out of all of the nasty stuff and their feet injury, they typically come in here to get their exams and get their things taken care of. So it's not a big enough trailer where you can just use it, right? If you see 50 or 70 or 100 animals in a day, having them all come through here would be chaotic. But having this support, a tent or a triage area, works beautifully. And that's the way we tend to use our medical trailers. And the reason we have three is if we're in a really big event, we might need one trailer here and another trailer down the road at another location and another trailer maybe in the next county. You know, in Harvey, we were spread out in multiple different counties. And so having the ability to have trailers in different locations supporting different things is the reason for the numbers. Same on the other side with the larges, except the larges, we don't have an indoor space for them. Their drugs are in typical field service truck kind of platforms. But it's all behind supporting either a shelter system, a triage system to where you can treat an animal that doesn't have an owner and then get it into the shelter system. Or let's say that dog I just talked about that we discovered that was in really bad shape and we brought him in here. Our first goal is to stabilize him and say, can this dog, has he got a good prognosis if he just gets the right care, right? And then our next step is start to reach out to our veterinary partners that are at their practices and say, are you willing to take this dog? He doesn't have an owner present with him, but he's got this. Are you willing to take that on? Yes or no? It's, you know, they might be overwhelmingly busy and can't. And so that's the process. Try to get them to higher level care. If we can't get them to higher level care and their problems are serious, life-threatening, or inhumane not to find care, right? That's when the whole conversation of euthanasia may come in, but it's always the last resort, right? You presume every animal in disaster to be owned, just doesn't have its owner. And so you're trying to save every single one unless it doesn't make sense for the animal's sake, right? Their injuries are so severe. You can't stabilize them. You're doing everything you can, but they're not getting stable. Yeah. And then we have to have those difficult conversations. We've been very lucky, honestly. Euthanasias always happen in disasters because animals get bad things happening to them. Bad burns. The house fell on them in the tornado, and it's a catastrophic injury. Things like that. There's always going to be those. But we really work hard to trying to find the ability to get them to care if we can. Yeah. Because we know it belongs to somebody that just lost a house or just lost whatever, right?
Right. So, and if they're still out there, they're going to come looking for their baby.
That is 100% right. Yeah. We all being animal people are like, ain't no stopping until you kind of have to stop, right?
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting and very heartwarming. Kind of gave me the chills because in those disaster situations, there is a lot of chaos, a lot of desperation, a lot of pain, and having the ability to come in and support the community in that way, in a way that most people don't even think about.
Most people just think we'll take them to the veterinarians, and the truth of the matter is that's where they should go. Mm-hmm. But if it's an animal that's been lost, there's no owner attached to it. When you take it all to the veterinarian, they're already super busy because the chaos has created a busyness for them. But if an owner is not present, that now puts a financial and legal liability on them that's very difficult. And by us being able to take that piece away from, they can do their day job, they can keep doing what they do, but we can now take those animals that don't have that owner present and do something for them. They can help us with some of those, but some of them we can just take care of ourselves, get them into the shelter system, which is where mom's going to come to find them. And so that's the beauty of this entire relationship. We don't go into a community to be a vet clinic. We go into a community to be partners with the vet clinics, to be partners with the shelter teams, to be partners with the rescuing groups, to make sure all of those animals get care and get back to mom. That's the whole goal. That's the whole goal. And it doesn't matter if it's a horse or a cow or what. It's find it, get it care, and get it back to mom. Or dad.
Yeah, or dad. How did we do in the pandemic? What did we learn from that? And and have you had any thoughts about how we can better prepare for the next pandemic?
Oh, girl, that's a great question. That's a hard question. Because we're not, in my opinion, any better prepared for the next one. It's natural human behavior to deny that those things are going to happen again, right? It's natural. So let's scroll back to the pandemic and COVID. So as a vet team, we were actively involved back at the campus because when we all moved out of our hospitals, even though we were eventually designated as essential personnel and all those things, we actually used this trailer and several of our trailers as part of the front door to the College of Veterinary Medicine when that first started.
Really?
Yes.
How did that look? So, how did that work out?
So we turned the back side of the hospital where it's typically the large animal entrance, that whole area is a lot of space out there. and we used our command trailer to become the outdoor admissions desk. We used three of our medical platforms to become, if you have an animal that needs triage, I mean, it's in tough shape and it needs to go to the ER. Remember, we were out of the building. People were not in the building. So we used them as the outdoor triage places so that we could figure out, can he go inside and what's the situation? It was, that first month was chaos. We were able to use a lot of these platforms very helpfully at first. We were using our decon because we thought we had to decon all of those animals before they could go inside.
Right.
We were just learning on the go.
Yes.
Dr. Bissett, after the first 6 weeks we were at the school and things started finally getting to where there was a flow and they were going inside. People were staying outside, but animals were going inside. We figured it out. We didn't have to bathe everything. Dr. Bissett actually got requested to go help in the panhandle doing all of the contact tracing, because that's a management problem where people that are used to the incident command system that we work in, the management structure of disaster, going in and helping organize that chaos on the contact tracing side. So we were involved in COVID in many different ways. Ultimately, I will tell you, I think infectious disease, the next infectious disease thing, is just as important as the next disaster that we're going to deal with, whether it's an Ebola thing, it's an African swine fever thing, it's the next flu, I don't know, who knows what it's going to be, we don't know what it's going to be. Veterinarians are going to have to be involved because people and their animals. One of the biggest worries that I had early on that never materialized, thankfully, but I still worry about it, is had COVID actually be easily transmitted by dogs or cats? Could you have imagined that nightmare? All of the people dumping all of them, all of the animals needing a place to be, all of the animals needing a place to be sheltered while their people. That was my terror, was that COVID was going to be identified to be something that was a source of people illness. Oh dear. That disease is coming. Of course, we're in the business of planning for the worst and going for the best. And that idea, that one terrified me.
Yeah.
And especially since it's a coronavirus, right? Because I was like, you know, animals like to do this too. So, but yeah.
Yeah, and it was very scary the first month or two, however long it took us to figure out it wasn't too horribly transmissible with our pets. I remember trying to go on walks because we couldn't be really inside with people. So we go outside, get in the sunshine, and you so naturally go to pet someone's dog. Go to say, oh, what's their name? And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking, well, how many other people have pet this dog? You know, maybe we shouldn't be petting dogs right now.
You are 100% right. I mean, that was why we were bathing dogs that came to the vet school. Is he carrying the stuff that's going to give it to us? So let's get it off of him. And it was a really challenging time. And until you figure out what the virus is doing and how it's doing it and how it's being transmitted, you have to play that way. I mean, I go back to 2014. That was the year of the Ebola patient. Dr. Bissett and I were the two people that took care of that dog because they were scared to death that dog, having lived with the nurse, Nina Pham, who was the person that took care of the person that died from Ebola and then got the disease, everybody was afraid the dog had Ebola and was going to spread it everywhere. And so they took the dog out of her apartment, took him over to Grand Prairie to the Naval Air Station there, and put him in quarantine. And then they said, okay, now how are we going to take care of him? And so they called us. And so we spent 21 days taking care of Bentley, Nina Pham's dog.
Wow.
In PPE.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. And so the dog was okay.
The dog was okay. It was a little terrifying for, at first, because honestly, none of us knew whether or not this dog had Ebola or not. We had to wait at least a week before we could test him. So after a week of quarantine, then we drew his blood and collected some pee and collected some poop from him. And it all got analyzed. And the first set of tests were negative, so everybody starts relaxing a little bit. And then we did it again at week two, and the tests were all negative, so everybody relaxes a little bit more. And then we got to week three, and he was negative, and he got released, and we got to give him back to his mom.
Okay.
And that was amazing on every level. There was 3 weeks of, like, can you imagine doing this for 500 dogs? No.
No. No. That would be a terrifying job.
But that's what infectious disease can do to us.
Yeah. All of the uncertainty.
The uncertainty. You don't know. So quarantine, oh man, that would have been, wow. So yes, we have little touch points of experience with those kind of events, with Ebola and COVID, but there's another one coming.
Yeah. Two last questions for you. Anything else veterinary professionals should know from the veterinary emergency?
Okay, so my big thing for them, for their own selves, is be prepared on your own self, right? Make sure your own family has its own plan, either for evacuation or what do? We have the next snow, but and the power's out and all of the things. Prepare yourself. And then at your practice level, not only make sure your practice has a plan, you know what to do in the event you need to evacuate it. You know that you're in a floodplain. You know this thing could flood if the Harvey reappears. You know this, we're in Tornado Alley. Where's our safe shelter? You know, basic preparedness things. But this is the real one for me, from them. Talk to your clients. Make this part of what you do. Tell them they need to be prepared. If they have animals, they need to take them with them. That means you have to have a go bag for them too. If they don't have people in authority, like veterinarians, helping them, here's where to go for a go kit, here's where to go for doing this, here, go to AVMA, go to TVMA, go to wherever. Have your own stuff. Because that, it doesn't make bad things from happen, but it absolutely, the more of them that get out of harm's way, the less of them we have to rescue, the less of them we have to take care of. And that's really important. The second thing I would say is, if you have an interest in more of this, one of the things that we are really going to actively try to do over the next years is to expand the cadre of people in Texas with the assistance of the TVMA that are a roster of individuals that can be called upon to help in a disaster that are veterinarians and technicians and people that help, that know animals and want to help on the animal side. It's an expansion of us. We can't be everywhere all the time. Most disasters are local, so we need local people to know how to take care of themselves and then know how to ask for the bigger help when they need it. And so that's going to be the next big thing for us, is really push to get the veterinary community across this state, which is so huge,
Yes, this really has me thinking about what go kit do I have? What's my plan?
And even if you have one like I have, you have to refresh it. And that's something I have to kick myself in the behind every once in a while and say, you know what, you haven't replaced your water, or you haven't done the thing, or
Something's
it's
expired.
It's a constant thing.
Yeah, so something good to think about, because once the emergency happens, everyone's trying to prepare a go kit at the same time. You don't want to be battling for the toilet paper or anything
else. Of the things. That's right. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And last question for you that I'm asking all veterinarians, because I am trying to help veterinarians be reminded of why they got into veterinary medicine in the first place. What is it that brings you joy from this profession that helps you keep going when you have a really hard time?
So that question is a great question. And I'm going to talk about it for my current job, not my previous job. In my previous job as an internist, it was different, obviously. There's a lot of that I still feel very passionately about, but in my current job is just, it is being able to help people when they've had the worst day of their life. And as a veterinarian, whether it's an individual animal, worst day of your life, you know, that dog or cat or horse that you've had for 20 years, that's your heart animal. You know, that's a thing that's powerful for us. But now that I have become passionately consumed by being a disaster responder, we are there on the ground when people have really just been. Mother Nature does bad things. Man-made horribleness can do really bad, you know, trains that explode and burn things and all of the horrible things that can happen in life. We can't make those go away, but man, is it rewarding as a veterinarian to be there to help some small way the animal side of that. And so, yeah.
I bet that feels pretty amazing.
It's tough because it's tough, right? The people have just had horrible, horrible stuff happen, and the animals have had horrible, horrible stuff happen. But if you can just help a little bit of it, it makes a big difference for them. And I think for all of us, when you can help somebody else, it helps you.
Absolutely true. I love that. Thank you for doing this interview. It's been a joy.
Good. Thank you.
A few quick announcements. Save the date for TVMA Annual Conference in Irving, Texas, February 29th through March 3rd. It's a great place to get your CE and meet others in the profession. We hope to see you in February. Veterinary professionals in Concho Valley are invited to join us for quality continuing education before the end of the year. We'll visit Concho Valley on November 18th and 19th. Learn more about the session and register online at tvma.org. Lastly, the 2024 sponsorship prospectus for TVMA opportunities is now available on our website. Go to tvma.org and navigate to Education and Opportunities. If you have any topics you would like covered on this podcast or would like to nominate a guest, please email me at awood@tvma.org. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with a colleague and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. A like, a share, a retweet, these are all great ways that you can support TVMA that won't cost you a dime. I'm your host, Audrea Wood. Thanks for listening.